What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is political science professor Faten Goshen of the University of Arizona, discussing the aftermath of the Arab Spring, especially the Syrian civil war and Lebanon. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You know, there are times in a rabbi's life when his principal role seems to be fulfilling life cycle events, both sad and celebratory. Our job is, in the old rhyme, to hatch 'em, match 'em, and dispatch 'em. Or as my cantorial father once said of a long-ago film title, Four Weddings and a Funeral, that was my weekend. In the last 3 weeks or so, my own congregation has experienced 12 congregational deaths, and I've found myself conducting 8 funerals or memorial services, as well as a number of Shiva Minyan's home services of remembrance. Intermingled during this period have been 3 B'nai Mitzvah, 3 Brises, and a wedding, all happy events, plus a couple of conversions. While this is not exactly a typical period of time, it is also not unique. Bar and bat mitzvahs and weddings are scheduled far in advance, of course, but we do not have the luxury of knowing when somebody will be born or die. In the course of a year as a congregational rabbi, I'll sometimes experience periods as long as a month without a funeral or a birth, and then find myself deluged by them. Sometimes it's lots of births, sometimes it's lots of deaths. The birth stuff, the Brit Milah celebrations and baby namings are typically delightful and easy, fun, and they bring joy to everyone, except sometimes the 8-day-old boy. But funerals and memorials present a particular challenge. Death always takes on the highest priority for a rabbi, as the mitzvot of accompanying the dead and consoling the bereaved are crucial for every true Jewish community. The powerful and wise Jewish rituals for experiencing grief and mourning need to be observed as fully as possible in order to allow for proper remembrance and emotional healing to take place. But with no way to know when the need will arise, and no easy way to prepare for it, the sudden arrival of the urgent requirement to assist a bereaved family disrupts schedules and changes routines, challenging a rabbi to rise to the occasion and provide the essential support that every family needs in these circumstances while continuing to go to teach classes and students, attend meetings, lead services, visit the sick, and all the other daily requirements of the rabbinic job. We become congregational rabbis because we want to help people and fill a need. When someone dies, we are needed, we can help, and we must. The conundrum is that our regular work does not go away, and choices must be made. Assisting a family with an impending death, with the funeral or memorial, meal of condolence, Shiva Minyanim, the preparation, travel, phone calls, emails, texts, and personal responses, can take a rabbi anywhere from 5 to 20 working hours for each memorial experience. It's truly holy work. But it is also challenging work for a rabbi. It requires intelligence, sensitivity, concentration, and time. It's that last piece, making the time to do it right, that presents the greatest challenge. We don't accomplish this alone, and strong support from staff, volunteers, and especially our own families is essential to let us do what we need to do for others. But there's also no doubt that doing this work, which is at the heart of what a rabbi does, and makes us feel needed and valuable, simultaneously takes something out of you. You cannot give always, and still have as much left after. This is not to complain. Frankly, I love the sacred quality of this sensitive, important work, and the understanding that it is fulfilling a true and timely mitzvah. It's just that there comes a point in which, to borrow a biblical analogy from Ecclesiastes, we are pouring from a pitcher that is starting to empty. And after we say, Baruch Dayan Emes, God is the true judge, we also know that very little is really within our own control, only our actions and attitudes. And so we say, following the traditional formula, may we meet primarily for simchas, happy occasions. This week in Israel, they will commemorate a happy occasion, the 46th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem in 1967. Yom Yerushalayim is a truly minor holiday commemorating a truly major event, the conclusion of the miraculous Six-Day War, when Israel was engaged with the much larger armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and defeated them all convincingly. The Israelis ultimately recaptured the old city of Jerusalem 19 years after the Jordanians had taken it away during the War of Independence. The reunification of the eternal capital of the Jewish people, made so 3,000 years ago by King David, was truly a world-changing event. And today, the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem, really all of the old city, is magnificent. But unlike Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, which is a countrywide celebration in Israel, Yom Yerushalayim is really just celebrated with a big military parade that clogs up all the traffic in Jerusalem for the day. I have been in Jerusalem twice during Yom Yerushalayim, once when I lived there and went to see the parade, and once later on a congregational pilgrimage when our touring schedule had to be completely reworked to accommodate the parade. The parade itself consisted of lots of Israeli military units of all varieties marching and trying to look spiffy. Unfortunately, this is not exactly the Israeli army's specialty. You see, the IDF, the Israeli military, is very good at actual, real military tasks like fighting and flying and surveillance and such, but it is pretty weak on the spit and polish side of military life. The motto of the Israeli army is Achorai, follow me, not march straight and look sharp. Trust me. And that emphasis on actual operational ability translates poorly to the parade ground, or the actual parade. You want beautiful marching? Watch the Egyptians. You want actual fighting ability? Go for the Israelis. All that aside, the reunification of Jerusalem has been taken for granted for a long time by most Israelis and most Jews around the world, but it is still something to remember and celebrate. Today we'll do it with the greatest of the songs about Israel, Jerusalem of Gold, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, written by Naomi Shemer weeks before the Six-Day War, and sung by Shuli Natan, with an additional verse from Naomi Shemer added after the war brought the old city and the Kotel, the Western Wall, back to us.
ושל נחושת ושל אור. בבואי היום לשיר אלך ולהחליק שורק תערים קפונתי מצעיר בנייך ומאחרו מהמשוררים כי שמך צורבת השפתיים כי נשיקת שערך אם אשכחך ירושלים אשר כולה של נחושת ושל אור עלו לכל שירייך אני כינור ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור עלו לכל שירייך אני כינור חזרנו אל בורות המים לשוק ולעתיקה שופר קורא בהר הבית בעיר העתיקה ובמערות אשר בסלע אלפי שמשות זורחות נשוב נרד אל ים המלח בדרך יריחו
That was Jerusalem of Gold, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav for Yom Yerushalayim this week, celebrating the reunification of Jerusalem 46 years ago. The beautiful extra verse that Naomi Shemer added includes the joyous statement that the area before the Western Wall is again filled with the sound of the shofar and the joyous songs of returning Jews. You know, we had Shuli Natan, that singer, at my temple for the 40th anniversary of the reunification. She still sounded wonderful. When we come back on Two Jewish This Morning, we'll meet our guest, Professor Faten Goshen, and discuss Israel's neighbors in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. What's really going on in the Syrian Civil War? How does Lebanon work? And what role should the U.S. have in all of this? Find out when we come back on Two Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now event priced at just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. I am delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Faten Goshen, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Arizona, and, an expert on the Middle East, which is always interesting to us. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You travel regularly to Lebanon, you know, Syria, Iran. I think most Americans know very little and understand very little about the Syrian civil war. It's an important issue for our listeners. Can you give us a little bit of a background?
Well, I mean, the civil war in Syria began initially when protesters took the streets around March 2011, and they were demanding some political and economic reforms. The interesting thing about the situation in Syria is that there was a number of protesters that were against the regime were actually lower compared to counter demonstrations early on for the regime. However, within about 3 months of that conflict, as a result of the violent crackdown by the regime, we quickly saw an armed militant or an armed rebellion and occur, and they began to carry out several ambushes against the regime, as well as utilizing terrorist tactics such as bombings inside of the city areas, and led to massive beginning of casualties. What began as a nonviolent protest quickly, within less than a year, turned into a full-scale civil war. The interesting thing about the war or the civil war in Syria and the dynamics there is that early on, most of the protests that happened were requesting political and economic reforms. Some protests were also extending political economic reform, but also regime change. So in an attempt to try to appease the those that were calling for political and economic reform, but maybe not necessarily going all the way out to call for regime change, the president, Assad, presented a new constitution which encompassed several concessions, such as the elimination of guarantees of the Ba'ath regime winning the majority of the parliament, as well as restricting a timetable for the president, term limits, as well as that the president would only be allowed to be reelected one more time. And it was interesting, it went out for a referendum, and I believe about 56% came out and voted, and the 56%, overwhelmingly about 83%, voted for the political and economic reforms. However, at that time, the rebels began to, they tried to intimidate people going to the polls. They didn't want anyone to vote because they believed unless the regime back is brought down, then there's no compromise on that. And so things have escalated since then. Now that you have foreign fighters, you have the Free Syrian Army, but that's divided. You have so many brigades. I saw one article one time in the Lebanese newspapers that listed over 20 different groups fighting in there. And those are the ones that we know of or have made a name for themselves. And so it's a much more complicated situation. Interesting thing is that minorities in Syria have mainly either stayed out or sided with the government. So you've got the Christian, the Druze, and the Alawites. Some have openly come out for the regime. Some have said that we're not with the opposition, maybe not said we're with the regime, but at least not with the opposition. And so it's a very, I mean, unfortunately, a complicated conflict right now.
Very messy conflict. We will talk much more with Fatin Goshen about the Middle East, kind of a tour d'horizon. We'll get a clearer picture on what's going on all through the region when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We are now pleased and serene as we bring you an occasional feature of 2Jewish, our Zen Judaism segment. Accept misfortune as a blessing. Do not wish for perfect health or a life without problems. What would you have to talk about? Do not let children play contact sports like football. These lead to injuries and instill a violent, warlike nature. Instead, encourage your child to play peaceful games like sports doctor. And finally, if a Jewish husband is walking alone in the forest talking to himself, is he still wrong? Those were our Zen Judaism teachings, our koans, koans for today. We welcome our maven on Israel and yet again brand new father, Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov, Guy, Mazel Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
And you look great, a little tired. Baby rituals, are they any different for Jews living in Israel from Jews living here in the States?
Well, you know, babies are our happiness. Babies bring joy. I think in Israel, maybe the celebrations are a little more out there. More people celebrate, the family, the friends. It seems that, I don't know, people are less, they tend to show their happiness more. I'm trying to phrase myself carefully.
Yeah, you got to be careful here. Because, you know, Americans like babies too. But I think that Israel is less restrained about stuff in general. People can be more openly emotional.
People definitely are more openly emotional. You know, when you have a baby in the hospital and an hour later you have 50 of your relatives already arriving at the hospital with flowers and candy and whatever not, and doing the big celebration already there. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes you might be a bit tired, especially the mother. But it's fun. It's part of this family thing. I think those are the main differences. Although even here, I can tell you that without mentioning names, 15 minutes after the baby was out, we already had some friends that probably became more Israelis than they thought. They're American Jews, and they came to the hospital and did a big celebration for us, and it was really fun. So apparently things are quite the same.
Kind of the same, yeah. I would think. So, obviously, you know, Bris is standard. You had a boy. Do they do baby namings for girls in the same way in Israel that we do in the States?
I need to be honest and say that I don't know in what way are you doing it in the States. People do some ceremonies for girls and do a big party, usually for a boy and a girl. Of course, for the girl, you don't have the formal bris, so you don't need to do it on the eighth day.
Right,
you
can not take, quite as stressful.
Yeah, so it's a little easier on that part. But of course, the girls, when they grow up, they make sure you pay for having anything easier later
on.
So don't worry.
I have a 12-year-old girl. Just trust me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So basically, people are very happy. One tradition that I don't know if you do here when it's your firstborn boy, There is often the tradition of Pidyon Haben.
Pidyon Haben, right.
Which is a tradition to do on the 30th day, I guess.
Yeah, Orthodox Jews do it, some conservative Jews, and as a Reform rabbi, I've done it probably 5 or 6 times in 14 years in my congregation here. So, and a couple of times in my old congregation. So it does still occur in the Reform movement, but not much. But in Israel, it's still very common for firstborn male.
It's quite common. We did it for our son. It was very nice. You know, it's a nice ritual, and it's happy, and another excuse to have a great meal with friends and families, and to bring all those silverware and stuff that you need to give to the Kohen, and to buy your
child back.
Child,
right?
Back. It's nice, you know, it's fun. It's fun.
Well, Guy, mazel tov. May you see many simchas, only simchas with your new son, and also may you get some sleep.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And it's not too long ago we commemorated Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Eventually that kind of connects to Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day. But you like to teach from a book by a guy named David Vital. Let's talk a little bit about the state of European Jewry and how that fractiousness actually contributed perhaps to the Holocaust.
Well, it's a subject we've talked about before in kind of a general way, which is the almost chronic, since at least the time of the Romans, if not also the time of the Greeks, disunity of the Jewish people, the division into various camps and sects and groups of opinions. And I mean,
it's 2 Jews, 3 opinions, 4 synagogues, 5 organizations.
Exactly. And it seems that we've always been this way and that it has been a historic weakness. I think one exception to that was in medieval Christian Europe, where Jews were locked into ghettos and didn't really have any organizations because they all lived together. They all had to get along. They were all Orthodox. There weren't different degrees of belief or doctrine. And so there was de facto a community to which people belonged that policed itself and had its own rules and didn't really have to interact with other communities. So at the point in history where there were, in effect, no Jewish organizations, in some ways, one could argue, Jews thrived the most, both before and after that. Whether in Israel or in the diaspora, Jews seem to get into trouble when there's a plethora of organizations that compete for resources and compete for the position of being the authentic voice, if you will, of the Jewish community or the Jewish people or the Jewish nation, however it's defined. So in the book to which you referred, which is called A People Apart by David Vital, Vital, who's a British academic who eventually made Aliyah and moved to Israel, so you sort of know where he stands on a lot of issues already, begins actually with a case study that predates the time frame of his book. On the cover of his book, it says, A History of European Jewry from 1789, which of course is the French Revolution, to 1939, which is the outbreak of World War II. He actually begins with a detailed case study of a decree issued by Maria Theresa, the Austro-Hungarian Empress, in 1744. And this was a decree issued by a woman who was arguably the most competent, intelligent, powerful ruler in Europe, certainly on the continent, in the 18th century. And based on misinformation, she wanted to expel the ancient Jewish communities of Bohemia, and particularly the Jewish community of Prague. And his opening case study examines how Jews across Europe, including the UK and including Istanbul, took coordinated, if not united, action to intervene through various royal courts to get Maria Theresa to rescind this decree and basically save these Jewish communities, not from extermination, but from expulsion, from having to sell their stuff, take to the roads, relocate, et cetera, et cetera. And then the question he raises, which we won't obviously get to till next week, is why is it that 200 years later, after two centuries of emancipation, education, integration, assimilation, were the Jews of Europe so incapable of defending themselves against a much less competent, much less intelligent ruler named Adolf Hitler when the Holocaust reared its ugly head? And we can begin to, at least, to talk about that next week.
Fascinating question. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Tom. It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Isaac has been quietly perusing a document for some time. His wife Rose is getting curious, so she asks him, "Nu, Isaac, what are you reading?" "Our ketubah, our marriage contract," he replies. "But you've been staring at it for an hour," she says. "I know," Isaac replies. "I'm looking for something." "What are you looking for, Isaac?" asks Rose. "An expiration date," he replies. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its English name by a census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. The Hebrew name for this portion and this book, Bamidbar, means in the wilderness. While the name comes from the first words of the book, it has a greater resonance and meaning than simply its lexicographical location. It also speaks of place in a different and powerful way. Every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems we must head out into the desert. It was true for Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses, and after the Exodus, it's true as well for the whole people of Israel, who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar Sinai, the desert, seeking God and revelation. Why must we head out into nothingness in order to find truth? Perhaps it's simply because our own lives are so filled with complication and complexity, which seem critical during our daily grind, but most of which turn out to be truly unimportant. But until we leave behind the conveniences of home, until we divest ourselves of our comforts and conceits, we are unable to really understand what truly matters. Faith blooms freely in the desert, for there is nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it really is, coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator and maker of covenants. You too can find God in the wilderness. And this is just as true in the Sonoran Desert, by the way, as it was in the Sinai Desert for our ancestors. You simply need to look for God, away from all the complications of daily life. The poet asks, "Must we enter the desert to hear your voice?" To which we might answer, "Yes. But we still need to listen." When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Faten Goshen, will tell us all about Israel's neighborhood, the Syrian Civil War, Lebanon, and America's role in dealing with the aftermath of the Arab Spring. Find out how it all works when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Iranian man who attacked a Paris rabbi last week had assaulted another French Jew in the same area a few days earlier, the French Jewish community's security services said. The attacker was arrested April 23rd for lightly wounding the rabbi and his son with a knife. He had struck a young man 4 days earlier with an iron bar as the man was exiting a Paris synagogue. The victim of the first attack was hit in the head several times. The rabbi was attacked last week, suffered a cut on his throat, and his son had cuts on his upper body. Police were able to establish a link between the two incidents through video surveillance. The attacker, in his late 20s, escaped from a psychiatric institute near Lyon in eastern France last month. In Los Angeles, the FBI arrested an L.A. man who allegedly operated a Ponzi scheme targeting the city's Iranian Jewish community. Shervin Davatgarjadeh, also known as Shervin Naaman, was taken into custody last week on suspicion of defrauding $3 million from mostly Jewish Iranian-American investigators, the FBI said. According to the indictment, Davatgarjadeh posed as a hedge fund manager promising to invest in the Los Angeles real estate market. He is suspected of using the investments instead to illegally pay for a lavish lifestyle for himself and his wife, including a $60,000 wedding ring, luxury cars, and a fancy office. The Iranian Jewish community in Los Angeles has been rocked by a series of such Ponzi schemes in recent years. In March, a U.S. district court sentenced an Iranian Jewish radio talk show host and businessman, John Farahi, to 10 years in prison for swindling $24 million from dozens of victims, mostly Iranian Jews. And in October of 2011, Iranian Jewish businessman Ezri Namvar was sentenced to 7 years in jail for stealing $21 million from four clients. The European Union's police body, Europol, said last week that indications suggest strong links between Hezbollah and the deadly terrorist attack in Bulgaria last year. Europol has adopted the findings of a six-month-long investigation by Bulgarian security services into the July 2012 bombing of a bus of Israeli tourists in Burgas. It left five Israelis and a Bulgarian dead and dozens wounded. In February of this year, a Bulgarian minister said the attack was carried out by agents of Hezbollah's military wing with funding provided by the Shiite group. The Bulgarian probe led to renewed calls for the European Union to join the U.S., Israel, the Netherlands, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand in classifying Hezbollah as a terrorist group. According to various insiders, however, some EU countries, including Germany and France, are reluctant to take this step because it might harm their relations with Lebanon, where Hezbollah is part of the government. And finally, in a feel-good story, descendants of Jews from Cape Verde rededicated a burial plot in the West African island state, largely thanks to funding by the King of Morocco. The rededication took place earlier today in Praia, the capital, and was attended by a small group of Jews from four continents, including André Azoulay, a senior advisor of King Mohammed VI of Morocco. By the way, I met André Azoulay on a rabbinic mission trip to Morocco about 16 years ago. He's a very impressive guy. Several hundred Jews from Morocco settled in Cape Verde in the 19th century when it was still a Portuguese colony. The community has since basically disappeared, but the Moroccan government has been a major benefactor, along with a variety of other Jewish and non-Jewish donors, for efforts to preserve and restore the heritage sites, according to Carol Castile, overseeing the project as president of the Cape Verde Jewish Heritage Group. The Moroccan involvement in restoring the Praia burial site, one of several scattered across the 10 islands that make up Cape Verde, is part of a broader effort that recently led to the renovation of Casablanca's Jewish Museum, the reopening of the ancient synagogue in Fez, and plaques at Jewish schools across Morocco. Nice to hear. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. This is Professor Faten Goshen of the Department of Political Science at the University of Arizona, an expert on the Middle East. We began talking about the Syrian civil war and the complexity of all the many different groups. I think for most Americans, all they see is this is kind of part of the Arab Spring. It's another dictatorial, tyrannical regime that's fallen, but it doesn't look like it's going to be a democratic successor no matter what. How accurate is that picture?
I think, the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening is a much more complicated phenomena than we try to, or the media has tried to portray it. I think you have to think about there's several different phenomena that were happening. What we're seeing in, what we saw in places like Egypt or Tunis, even protests like in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, are one type of phenomena, the nonviolent protests of people coming out to the streets. What we saw in Libya, in Syria, and in Yemen, they're more traditionally, we as political scientists study under armed rebellion. So the expectations and the phenomena already are different in terms of the dynamics of how an armed rebellion occurs versus protest and change or regime change and transitions, like I mentioned, the other countries or at least the protests for them. So the thing with the Syria, it's typical. It's like what's happening in Democratic Republic of Congo. It's really what's happening or has happened in a lot of the countries in Africa, in Asia. These are civil war where you have one side fighting for control for the power, for the government. Okay, and that's why we define the civil war. It's when one party believes or challenges through the usage of military violence, the state in order to rule. And so that's really what's happening in Syria. And so it's similar to other civil wars, even the one like in Lebanon in the 1970s, in terms of a challenge by groups for the state. So that's why it's different. And that's why in those cases, what we expect in terms of outcomes, either victory for the government, victory for the rebel, or negotiated settlement. And the last option is the violence stays at a lower level where it doesn't escalate to full scale, but there's still some violence going on in the communities. And so now, in this case, I think we're going to have three options. So far, the victory for the rebels does not seem to happen, or is not happening so far. And I think many people have argued it probably will not happen unless there's a massive international intervention. And then if that's the case, we have to ask ourselves, who are we intervening and on whose behalf and on whose side? Right now, something that's not discussed at all in the media, as much as it should, is that both sides have carried out war crimes and crimes against humanity. Yes, some people will point out that maybe the number of crimes committed by the regime may be more, but let's not forget the regime has more resources, and so we don't know if the only thing that's stopping the rebels is the lack of resources. But in international law, you don't count whether or not you have how many war crimes or how many crimes against humanity. A war crime is a war crime. A crime against humanity is a crime against humanity. So I think here as an international community, we need to talk about, are we willing to step in and hold accountable both sides? If not, then it seems very not safe, I would say, to just pick on one side, because then it's going to be a victor's justice. And what we may see is what's happening right now in Libya, where it's really a victor's justice, and groups are that were for so long being treated unwell by the regime, all of a sudden, now that you flipped it, now they're treating or they're taking out their revenge against those that mistreated them. And so that's not the solution either. I mean, if we're going to move forward, we need to think about the most stable ones are going to be, of course, negotiated settlements. And there the option is pretty open. You can have a transition government. You can bring in people from the regime and people from the opposition, maybe hold certain leaders accountable, the high up, but maybe have a transition. Because unlike what the media is trying to portray, there's a lot of support for maybe not necessarily the actions of the regime, but what the regime stood for. In Syria is one of the few nations in the Middle East that is a very much a secular regime. And so many of the religious communities were willing to give up their political freedom in return for their religious freedom, particularly Christians and Druze in this case. So they're like, we would rather live where maybe our political freedom are somewhat curtailed, but that we have total control over our religious freedom of expression. And so and so it's a complicated, and it's the good thing is it's not, it's similar to other civil conflicts that we have around the world. And so I think that's how we should treat it when looking at the outcomes.
So not so much as a religious war or two sides that are opposite poles, but really sides in which some kind of a negotiated settlement might be possible.
Yes. I mean, and you hear that a lot from even people that used to support the rebels early on or supported the cause are noticing that in many cases, you know, unfortunately, this is, you know, you see this in all civil wars. So what's happening in terms of rebel behavior or even some state groups' behavior is not unusual. Thinking of Peru and the Shining Path, how it started early on as wanting the rights of the freedoms of the indigenous population, protecting them, and slowly began to use tactics, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and even terrorist tactics. And so it's not unique what we're seeing in Syria. I think you're seeing some elements trying to make it religious, and I think those elements have infiltrated into the rebel groups, primarily these foreign fighters that are coming in from Iraq, and that came in, that were fighting in Iraq and now are in Syria, like the Jabhat al-Nusra, which we know has, which they've acknowledged has affiliation to Al-Qaeda. So this is the danger here. And what we've seen recently is the Free Syrian Army has said, yes, we're working with al-Nusra, and yes, however, we disagree that it's all foreign fighters. We think it's predominantly made out of Syrians. Oh, well, either way, it's bad, right? If it's predominantly made out of Syrians that thinking that way, it's bad. And if it's the foreign fighters bringing over this ideology, it's also bad. Because we are beginning to see some slogans. For example, recently I saw a slogan for Jabhat al-Nusra that says Christians to Beirut, Alawites to the grave. This is a translation. So they want to ethnically cleanse Syria, so all the Christians go to Lebanon.
Lebanon has a long Christian history. Lebanon's a country you know well also. Tell us what's going on in Lebanon. We know about the Hezbollah there, but fill us in a little bit.
Well, the situation in Lebanon, what's dangerous in this case, or what's become problematic, is that there's a spillover effect. Again, this is not unusual. In many cases, we are worried about civil wars because they have a possibility to spill over into neighboring countries. And this is something that we've seen in the Syrian case with respect to spill over into Lebanon and Jordan. With respect to Lebanon, you know, the relationship between these two countries has been impacted by Syrian intervention, the Lebanese civil war in the 1970s, but also, most importantly, the placement of Lebanon under the Syrian tutelage from 1990 until April 2005, after the assassination of the Sunni ex-prime minister of Lebanon, Rafi al-Hariri, in February 2005, and the alleged accusation that Syrian regime may have been either directly or indirectly involved with the assassination, relationship between these two countries has been very unstable. Recently, it's been circulated that Lebanese Sunni insurgents are actually believed to be fighting in Syria alongside the Syrian Free Army. It was interesting, and part of the reason is because many of the Syrians or the Sunnis feel a, of course, affiliation to the Sunni rebels inside of Syria. And, of course, we now have also allegations that Hezbollah fighters, you know, largely Shiite party in Lebanon, is also participating in the conflict, helping the Syrian regime as they are seen to have had or to know more knowledge in fighting guerrilla-style warfare. Now, the reason why we're seeing And a major implication is now Lebanon is hosting over 420,000 registered Syrian refugees, and there's a belief that there's over 200,000 unregistered Syrians in Lebanon, and those are the ones that have the money in order to be able to come in and rent their own places. They don't have to register through the United Nations. And this is complicating the problem because the Christians in Lebanon, the majority of them are now all of a sudden being concerned because it reminds them of the Palestinian refugee situation from conflicts with Israel in 48 and 67. And, you know, it reminds them of the Lebanese civil war, which lasted from 15 years, from 75 to 1990, and which was heavily politicized and left over 144,000 killed and over 180,000 injured. So now the Lebanese are worried because the Syrian refugee camps, they're bringing in their weapons. They're highly trying to now impose that they have freedom of imposing their law inside of Lebanon. And the reason why they're being able to do that is because the Sunni community, or parts of the Sunni community, is supporting them and saying that the Lebanese have to support the cause of their Sunni brethren. They're framing it in terms of a Sunni identity of the rebels against the fight of the Alawite dominant regime. This is quite dangerous for Lebanon because we're seeing an increase in crime rate carried out by some of these individuals, which is, again, nothing against. It's normal when we see refugee situations. We tend to see this kind of criminal activity, just because these are young individuals. They may not have means of income. They're placed in homes or in tents or in conditions that are miserable. So again, nothing against the Syrians per se. It's just something that's common that we see in such situations. So the Christians in Lebanon are quite worried. They're quite concerned because, again, it's for them, it's a replay of the Lebanese Civil War. Right. They want the state to be the main dominant impose its own security. Right. It's interesting, this led to a little quarrel with the last prime minister, who's from Tripoli, and Tripoli, highly not only Sunni, but Tripoli has always been seen as having strong relations with Syria. And they're actually, when Lebanon was formed in the 1920s by the French after the mandate, or the beginning of the mandate, the Tripoli wanted to be part of the Syrian state and not the Lebanese state. So they've always had this history. And so he resigned because of being pushed and pulled. And now Lebanon, I think both sides, the Sunni political leadership and the Shiite leadership, as well as the Christian leadership, have come together to quickly renominate a name and actually agree to a name. It was very fast. No one thought this would happen. They thought, you know, the Syrian conflict would play out more into the nomination of a prime minister. However, it didn't, because I think both sides have realized it's becoming totally out of control. So even the Sunni elites, political elites that are for probably the rebels, all of a sudden are realizing that's taking on a religious nature that they may not want to at this point.
You know, it always impressed me years ago, before the Lebanese Civil War, that Lebanon had found the balance between Christian, between Muslim, Shia, Sunni. Obviously, that fell apart completely and has been only carefully restored, and now it's again endangered.
I think part of the reason is I think there is a lot more harmony than people realize. And I think part of the problem is the fact of the matter that external battles get to be played on Lebanese soil. And, of course, here I will, you know, the Lebanese have part of that blame, where they allow external battles to be played in their own nation. So partly their fault, partly their, you know, position in the, or that where they located geographically in the Middle East. So I think there is much more understanding. People don't realize that in Lebanon, in terms of holidays, how much, you know, Christian holidays are respected, how much many Muslim families will, during Christmas, even, you know, they will go to their friend's house, celebrate Easter or Christian. And the same thing during Fitr, the Muslim holiday, you will find many Christian Lebanese in the homes of Muslims fasting with them. So I think there is a much more in terms of a population and acceptance, but I think you are beginning to see since 9/11, but more importantly since the 2003 war in Iraq, things have begun to shift in the Middle East, and not all of it to the better, unfortunately.
I want to thank Fatin Goshen for a great visit on Too Jewish and explaining as well as anybody possibly can Syria and Lebanon. And we'll get you back, talk about Iran sometime.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Marian Marzinski, the filmmaker of the powerful new movie, Never Forget to Lie, about child survivors of the Holocaust. He's an Emmy winner, by the way. The film will debut next week on Frontline. The Western Wall, the Kotel, is the holiest place in the world for Jews, and it has been in the news a great deal of late in its honor. And because Jerusalem Day is coming this week, our playout this morning is from Israeli singer Ofra Chaza, and it's called HaKotel, a beautiful song about the wall whose stones are world famous. The lyric is, "There are men with hearts of stone, but there are stones with human hearts." My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.